Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Driver's Story, Labor and Power in the World of Atlantic Slavery by Randy M. Brown, narrated by Tom Parks. Introduction. The story of the driver is the story of Atlantic slavery. It is a story of racial capitalism, a story about the exploitation of enslaved Africans and their descendants in the name of profit, the strategies enslavers used to force the people they enslaved to work to the utter limits of their endurance, and the human costs of plantation production. It is also a story of resistance and resilience, a story about people who fought back in spite of brutal consequences, built families and communities to sustain one another, organized strikes and rebellions, and insisted that their lives meant more than their status as enslaved laborers. Above all, it is a story of existential horror, a story about how people coped when they found themselves at the very center of the never-ending war between enslavers and the enslaved. The driving system, as it was known, dominated plantation societies throughout the Americas from the beginning of large-scale sugar production in the 17th century English Caribbean to the final abolition of slavery in the late 19th century. Its purpose was straightforward: to extract the maximum amount of labor from enslaved workers and thwart their resistance. Once established, the driving system's basic dynamics were surprisingly stable and similar throughout the Americas. Everywhere, the figure that had to make the system work in practice was the driver. This was an enslaved person, usually but not always a man, appointed by white plantation authorities to supervise, manage, and punish other slaves. The earliest references to drivers come from late 17th century Barbados, the small island where English planters revolutionized the production of sugar by developing a new model of labor organization and social control that would be replicated time and again as the plantation system spread throughout the Americas. The division of enslaved laborers into multiple, highly regimented work gangs. These gangs were supervised not by white employees, but by enslaved black people who came to be called drivers, a term until then used to describe people who drove working animals. If the plantation was, as some planters liked to imagine it, a machine, drivers were the ones tasked with making it work and preventing other enslaved people from sabotaging it. The driving system thus turned the fundamental problem of plantation production into the problem of the driver. To tell the story of the driver is to illuminate the lives of the people at the very heart of the plantation world. This is a story not only about labor extracted and withheld, about how plantations were managed, or about the ways enslaved people fought to negotiate the terms of their labor, tested the limits of their enslavers' power, and struggled to survive, although it is a story about all of those things. First and foremost, this is a story about drivers themselves, their predicament, their motivations, their harrowing struggles. It is a story about the life and death stakes of trying to get by on slave labor camps, from which escape was all but impossible. It is also a story told as clearly as possible from the driver's own point of view. How did drivers themselves understand their predicament and ordeal? How did they try to reconcile their status as enslaved laborers with their role as enforcers of labor discipline? How did they respond to, perpetuate, and resist the driving system? The title of this book draws on two distinct meanings of story. On many West Indian plantations, enslaved people used the word story not only as it is commonly understood today, to refer to a narrative or sequence of events, but also as shorthand for conflict, trouble, or struggle. As one enslaved man put it after a violent confrontation in a Caribbean cotton field, "I have story with the driver." Drivers inevitably found themselves at the center of conflicts with everyone around them, because their role trapped them between the insatiable labor demands of white plantation authorities and the resistance of other enslaved laborers. As a result, many of the stories about different drivers told here are necessarily stories of struggle. Struggle defined the life of the driver. Drivers struggled to meet the impossible expectations of their enslavers, to protect themselves from brutal reprisals when they failed, and to maintain a position that helped them outlive their peers. They struggled to get other slaves to obey their orders and respect their authority, and to calibrate their response when people defied them. Drivers struggled to develop social roles that transcended their official status as agents of planter power, building families and serving as leaders for the communities to which they belonged. They struggled to maintain their authority among the enslaved, even when their enslavers tried to humiliate them through demotion. And when resistance morphed into rebellion, drivers struggled with others to decide what kind of revolution they wanted. The driver's story played out on plantations across the Atlantic world for more than 300 years. To understand that story, I scoured a wide range of sources and scholarship on different Atlantic slave societies, from the precursors of the driving system in early 17th century Sao Tome in Brazil to the antebellum United States. I concentrated on Caribbean plantation societies in the 18th and 19th centuries, when the plantation complex and the driving system that made it possible were at their height, including the French colonies of Martinique and Saint-Domingue, Haiti, the Dutch Guianas, including Suriname, Cuba, and the British West Indies. Comparing various kinds of evidence from different places and periods allowed me to see that even as plantation societies changed over time and varied widely in their states of development, demographics, political and legal systems, and dominant crops, drivers' roles and the challenges they faced were remarkably consistent. Many of the individual stories told here, however, took place in a particular time and place, the early 19th century British Caribbean. That is because in this era, the shifting politics of slavery and abolition produced an explosion of new and unique types of evidence about slavery and plantation production. In the decades after Britain abolished its transatlantic slave trade in 1807, the metropolitan government orchestrated a series of uneasy compromises between abolitionists and planters, designed to gradually reform slavery through new laws meant to ameliorate the treatment of enslaved people, grant them limited legal rights, and better surveil plantation management. During this period of so-called amelioration, which lasted until the end of slavery in the British Caribbean in 1834, established colonies like Jamaica and Barbados successfully resisted metropolitan pressure, while newly acquired territories with less legislative autonomy were forced to reform their legal systems and adopt new forms of record-keeping. Among the most important consequences of this expanding surveillance apparatus for Trinidad, St. Lucia, and the Guiana colonies of Berbice and Demerara Essequibo was the appointment of legal officials known as fiscals and protectors of slaves. In the process of adjudicating enslaved people's complaints and investigating alleged violations of the law, the fiscals and protectors created a remarkable body of evidence with no parallel in other plantation societies. Extensive first-person testimony from thousands of enslaved people themselves, including hundreds of drivers. Enslaved people went to the fiscals and protectors with a wide range of grievances and goals, and their testimony ultimately produced an extraordinary archive that spans tens of thousands of pages. Many of the complaints they made stemmed from conflicts about work, conflicts that often revolved around the actions of drivers. People claimed that drivers punished them excessively, arbitrarily, or to settle some personal grudge, and that drivers pushed them to work beyond customary limits or their physical capacity. Complaining about drivers was always risky, since colonial authorities tended to privilege testimony from drivers and white plantation authorities. Drivers themselves described field laborers who refused to obey their orders, challenged their authority, and even physically attacked them. They also complained about white plantation authorities who gave them impossible workloads and then punished them for unavoidable shortfalls. And sometimes, white plantation authorities complained about drivers who sabotaged production or conspired with other enslaved people to resist the labor regime they had been appointed to support. Taken together, the records of the fiscals and protectors of slaves composed the single largest archive of first-person testimony from and about enslaved people in the Americas, and bring us as close as we can hope to come to the voices of drivers and other enslaved people. This archive thus offers an unusually raw and intimate view of the driving system, as described by enslavers, drivers themselves, and the other enslaved people drivers flogged and fought, befriended and married, protected and organized. Rich as this archive is, it is also limited. Complainants, defendants, and witnesses made difficult decisions about what to disclose, when to stay silent, and what kinds of narratives and evidence to offer. As a result, they told conflicting stories that often make it hard to know what really happened in any given case. At the same time, colonial authorities often paraphrased, summarized, and translated spoken testimony, especially from enslaved people, into the kind of English that they and their peers understood. Inevitably, this archive reveals more about some aspects of enslaved people's lives than others. Most cases that came before the protector or fiscal had to do with intense and violent conflicts about working conditions, resistance to the labor regime, and punishment. Consequently, this evidence may exaggerate the extent of conflict between drivers, other enslaved laborers, and white plantation authorities. A final challenge in using this archive is that it contains important gaps and silences, most notably the near total absence of female drivers. Nonetheless, enslaved people's testimony archived in the records of the fiscals and protectors offers an unparalleled view of drivers and the driving system in one of the largest slave systems in the Americas. Because the basic patterns that emerge from this archive correspond to what I have learned about drivers from other sources and in other places. The driver's story is not organized around comparisons between different slave systems or change over time. Instead, it is organized thematically around different dimensions of drivers' lives. To center drivers and the problems they faced, each chapter highlights the unstable, triangular relationships drivers negotiated with white plantation authorities and with other enslaved laborers. This approach allows me to explore the multiple roles drivers played at the center of other enslaved people's working lives, social relationships, and struggles against slavery. The driver's story begins with the origins of the driving system and the driver's fundamental predicament, emphasizing both the relentless surveillance and brutal discipline drivers faced at the hands of white plantation authorities, and the marginal advantages of being a driver rather than a field laborer. I then turn to the different strategies drivers used to negotiate insatiable labor demands from above and constant resistance from below, highlighting the existential horror that drivers faced in trying to do a job that was all but impossible in a world where failure could be deadly. Then, I shift away from labor and explore drivers' efforts to build families and exercise leadership within the communities to which they belonged, where drivers drew on broadly shared African Atlantic understandings of politics to negotiate social relationships. I then focus on drivers who were demoted, particularly those who continued to be seen as leaders by other enslaved people and provoked explosive confrontations with enslavers. Finally, I explore the agonizing dilemmas drivers faced during rebellion, which crystallized their politics and revealed that their aspirations were not necessarily the same as those of most other enslaved people. The figure of the driver has been of enduring interest to writers for more than two centuries. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, anti-slavery activists on both sides of the Atlantic depicted drivers as simple-minded agents of planter power corrupted by the brutal realities of slavery. More recently, historians, reggae artists, and novelists alike have tried to make sense of drivers' role in plantation management and complicated position in the slave community. Drivers appear as key antagonists in Marlon James's Book of Night Women, 2009, a powerful historical novel that centers on a group of enslaved women and girls on a Jamaican sugar plantation at the turn of the 19th century. In a slave society where white residents were vastly outnumbered by enslaved black people and the threat of revolt loomed large, drivers helped enslavers maintain control and made plantations productive through relentless surveillance and shocking violence. But if drivers were oppressors, they were also oppressed. At the most fundamental level, they were trapped in the same hellish world of slavery and capitalism that they were coerced into supporting. At the same time, as several historians have recognized over the past half century, Drivers also face the special challenges that came with being the men between the fundamentally opposed demands of enslavers and other enslaved laborers. Drivers thus found themselves, as the historian John Blasingham put it, caught in the no-man's land between management and labor. Exploring the driver's predicament offers a new approach to one of the enduring questions in the study of Atlantic slavery. How did enslavers manage to extract so much labor from the people they enslaved in the face of relentless resistance? Efforts to answer this question have taken many forms, but generally fall into two basic camps. Economic historians and other scholars who have focused on the business of slavery and its relationship to capitalism have demonstrated that plantations, especially those that produced sugar, were some of the most complex businesses of their time. Slave owners were ruthless capitalists. Seeking ever greater profits, they experimented with different strategies of management, accounting, and surveillance. The strategies they pioneered to exploit enslaved workers, moreover, would later be adapted to coerce nominally free wage laborers under industrial capitalism. Meanwhile, some historians more focused on the experiences of enslaved people themselves have argued that labor and labor resistance was at the center of enslaved people's daily lives. Enslaved laborers developed a range of strategies to exert some degree of control over the ways they worked, from collective bargaining and strikes to more dangerous acts of resistance such as marinage, attempted escape from slavery, and rebellion. As a result, they endured both routine violence and spectacular torture as enslavers tried to terrorize them into submission. Surprisingly, drivers have received relatively little attention from most historians of slavery, even as they commonly acknowledge that drivers played a central role in extracting labor and managing resistance. Focusing on drivers thus offers an opportunity to integrate the approaches and insights of two fields of study usually addressed separately. First, the business of slavery, and second, the social and cultural history of the enslaved. To understand how the plantation labor regime worked in practice and how enslaved people experienced, resisted, and shaped it, the driver's story develops a human history of the driving system. Doing so opens new and productive lines of inquiry. How did drivers negotiate the impossible problem of balancing pressure from above and resistance from below? How did they try to resolve labor conflicts in ways that allowed them to maintain their authority and a position that facilitated their survival? What happened when they failed? And how stable or fragile was a labor regime in which ground-level supervisors were drawn from the ranks of the enslaved? What emerges from my efforts to answer such questions is neither a straightforward story about the totalizing power of enslavers nor an account of enslaved people's heroic resistance. It is a messier story about fraught negotiations, contingent alliances, and difficult compromises. In foregrounding stories of individual people, the driver's story also builds on the robust tradition of scholarship on enslaved people's social relationships. For more than half a century, historians have shown that enslaved people responded to the threat of social death and natal alienation by developing strong social ties, building families and communities, and adapting African cultural practices to meet new needs. In many places, displaced Africans from the same broad geographic region came together to create new identities as members of diasporic nations, such as Coromantes or Congos, which became important social and political communities. Enslaved people were not only coerced laborers, but also husbands and wives, parents and children, shipmates and friends, youths and elders, spiritual healers and midwives, recent African arrivals, and Creoles. In the complex communities they built, cooperation and conflict coexisted as enslaved people struggled both against their enslavers and against each other. In the slave community, drivers were often at the center of enslaved people's interpersonal relationships. Here, I focus on drivers' leadership and explore their efforts to draw on the unique opportunities provided by their official status, the negotiating skills they developed as intermediaries, and widely shared African political practices to construct impressive social authority. To what extent did drivers' formal role at the top of the occupational hierarchy and close connections to white authorities compromise or facilitate their efforts to get their fellow slaves to see them as community leaders? How did male drivers try to adapt the political practices of their African homelands? Where would-be big men worked to recruit and retain followers, especially women, by offering scarce resources and protection to the very different conditions of chattel slavery in the Americas. When African-born drivers sought roles as kings or other leaders of diasporic national groups, what happened when their political aspirations clashed with those of other leaders? Exploring drivers' leadership ultimately illuminates new dimensions of the social worlds enslaved people created as they sought solace, belonging, and material support. Finally, the driver's story intervenes in ongoing debates about slave resistance, in particular, focusing on the painful decisions drivers had to make both in their day-to-day lives and in moments of crisis, exposes the limitations of the domination and resistance framework that continues to shape much scholarship. The analysis of drivers' politics I develop here underscores an important argument worth repeating, that a narrow focus on enslaved people's resistance to slavery is too simplistic to fully appreciate the complex power relationships of Atlantic slavery. It obscures the reality that the actions of many enslaved people, including and perhaps especially drivers, were motivated by other considerations, especially survival. Drivers' complex political calculations were laid bare when the ever-present possibility of rebellion forced them to choose sides. I focus on the pivotal roles that drivers played in rebellion, both to see enslaved people's war against slavery with fresh eyes and to better understand drivers' politics. What role did drivers' leadership in African national groups play in forming or undermining the kind of political communities and solidarities that were necessary to organize a successful rebellion? What motivated individual drivers to support, avoid, or oppose enslaved rebels? And when drivers did organize or lead rebellions, how did their previous experiences and investment in hierarchical political structures shape their goals and aspirations? Approaching resistance and rebellion from the driver's point of view ultimately reminds us that enslaved people did not share a common political vision, that drivers and other enslaved people disagreed on crucial questions of strategy, leadership, and goals, even when it came to revolution, reveals that enslaved people had a wide range of understandings about their world and about what sort of alternatives were possible or desirable. More broadly, centering drivers in histories of resistance to slavery allows us to see that the politics of the enslaved were, as much as those of any people, complex, contingent, and contested. Sources and method. To tell the driver's story is to confront the same basic problem all historians of slavery face trying to recover enslaved people's experiences. The overwhelming majority of the records in which enslaved people appear were produced by slave owners, merchants, and governments for their own purposes. The archives of Atlantic slavery, which reproduce the extreme imbalance of power between enslavers and the people they enslaved, were not generally designed to document enslaved people's own perspectives or voices. As a result, surviving records tend to offer only fleeting, fragmentary, and distorted glimpses of enslaved people's lives. When I set out to understand everything I could about drivers and the worlds they inhabited, I knew it would involve painstaking research. My search for drivers took me across the Atlantic world, from archives in Guyana, Cuba, and the United Kingdom, to rare book libraries in the United States. I've also benefited immensely, especially as the COVID-19 pandemic made research travel all but impossible, from the explosion of digitized primary sources now available online. Fortunately, drivers appeared virtually everywhere I looked for them. In hindsight, I'm not surprised, since drivers were at the center of plantation production, enslaved people's social lives, and resistance to slavery. Early on, I realized that one of the richest bodies of evidence for this project was an unusual set of legal documents from the British Caribbean, the records of the Crown officials known as fiscals and protectors of slaves. These records were the result of a series of major legal and political transformations in the early 19th century. The period between the abolition of Britain's transatlantic slave trade in 1808 and emancipation in 1834 was one of the most well-documented eras in the history of Atlantic slavery. During this period of amelioration, the metropolitan government pressured colonies to gradually reform slavery through new laws meant to grant slaves limited legal rights, improve their working and living conditions, and better regulate relationships between enslavers and the enslaved. While established West Indian colonies like Jamaica and Barbados were largely able to resist pressure to enact legislative reforms, colonies that Britain seized from other European powers in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, Trinidad from Spain, St. Lucia from France, and the Guiana colonies of Berbice and Demerara Essequibo from the Netherlands, were not. Those colonies also inherited different legal systems based on Roman law that recognized enslaved people's personhood and provided opportunities to seek redress by appealing to colonial officials. Under British rule, the responsibility for adjudicating enslaved people's complaints and documenting the progress of amelioration fell first on pre-existing legal officers, such as the fiscals in Guyana, and then on new crown officials known as protectors of slaves. Today, the records of the fiscals and protectors are part of the British Colonial Office CO series at the British National Archives, where they are organized into nearly 50 large bound volumes. Together, they compose tens of thousands of pages. The most unusual and valuable part of this archive are the first-person complaints from thousands of enslaved people. The records of those complaints and the investigations, prosecutions, and correspondence that sometimes followed vary widely, from a few sentences of terse summary to several dozen pages of carefully transcribed, near-verbatim testimony. Taken together, these records offer extraordinary insights into the experiences and concerns of different enslaved people in several British Caribbean colonies, including many drivers and the people they worked, lived, and otherwise interacted with. Like any archive, the records of the fiscals and protectors present several challenges. While the ostensible purpose of colonial authorities' adjudication of complaints was to uncover the truth, the very nature of the legal system in which they operated and the larger power dynamics of slavery had the opposite effect and pushed people to tell conflicting stories. When people testified, whether they were enslaved or free, and whether they appeared as complainants, defendants, or witnesses, they had to make fraught decisions about what to disclose, when to stay silent, and what kinds of narratives and evidence might lead to favorable outcomes, or at least protect them from the worst consequences. As a result, it's not always possible to tell what really happened in a given case. But unlike the legal officials, who were interested only in deciding whether a particular law had been violated and what verdict to reach, my reading of this evidence aims to understand not only what drivers did and what was done to them, but also how drivers and the people they interacted with understood their world and their relationships. Rather than smoothing over conflicting claims or pretending that we can always separate fact from fiction, I foreground the competing stories that emerge from this archive in order to explore the motivations, goals, and perspectives of different actors. And while I find it both necessary and productive to speculate beyond empirical certainty, I try to make clear the difference between what I believe we can know, what we can reasonably infer, what we can only imagine in light of other evidence, and what we ultimately cannot know. Moreover, while the most extraordinary thing about this archive is just how close it brings us to the actual voices of enslaved people, recorded testimony was not always a direct transcription of what people actually said. Colonial scribes often, though not always, paraphrased, summarized, and translated what they heard, especially when it came to enslaved people's speech, into the kind of English that they and their peers understood. As a result, when reading this evidence, I have attempted to distinguish testimony that is mostly paraphrased from that which appears to be relatively unfiltered by paying close attention to clues such as the use of the first person, the length and the level of detail, and the presence of African and West Indian terms, idioms, and syntax. I've also attempted to directly quote testimony only when I'm relatively confident that doing so comes close to what people actually said and how they said it. At the same time, this archive documents some aspects of enslaved people's lives better than others. The kinds of grievances enslaved people brought to the protectors and fiscals were shaped not only by their own concerns, but also by the legal system itself, which encouraged certain types of complaints. Most of them involved conflicts about working conditions, resistance to the labor regime, and punishment. This is not surprising, since these were some of the major issues that amelioration-era legal reforms were designed to address. Accordingly, this archive emphasizes conflicts that revolved around the driver's
sample complete. Ready to continue?